This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Memorial Day is upon us, the moment when all over the country, backyard gardeners can put in their own tomatoes. The season when the tomato begins to tell us again why it is so glorious and so embedded in our salads and sauces, our imaginations and our memories, our desires. We want the tomato of our dreams. This hour on Point, the hunt for the perfect tomato. You can join the conversation. Why do so many people get so worked up about tomatoes? Why is this odd fruit everything from the seductress to the workhorse of the world's kitchens? And what makes this the voice of summer? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Arthur Allen, longtime journalist and now tomato maven. His new book is Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Arthur, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I would love to start off with you right away, way down on the southernmost tip, as you describe it, of Mexico's Baja Peninsula. What took you down there in your tomato safari? What were you looking for? What did you find?
Well, I was really looking for two things. One, I was chasing down this turned out to be a wonderful man named Conti Rawal, who's a tomato breeder par excellence and really knows the tomato business backwards and forwards and is an extremely entertaining, extroverted individual who's a lot of fun to spend time with.
And a geneticist who's been right into the heart of what makes tomatoes tomatoes.
That's right. He's a geneticist, but he's also a practical breeder. So he knows the science, but he also sort of is a little bit skeptical, one might say, of what the science can achieve in any given moment, including the moment we're in. And then he introduced me to these wonderful people who organized this tomato growing cooperative down in Baja California, which employs about 300 families, and they grow tomatoes, their little cherry grape tomatoes for the market in the United States. They're under the brand Del Cabo. So I spent about a week hanging out with them and Conti, and it was just fascinating and very, very nice.
And ended up with some really wonderful tomato tasting. You paint this great picture. Here you are down southern tip of Baja, all kinds of tomato places around the world. But here's a great one. They just carved out a new farm, sort of or patch big as a football field, maybe in 12 rows wide. You got banana plants and sunflowers around and hummingbirds and butterflies. And your Gujarati-born Conti, sort of the geneticist and planter, picks them up and tastes something that just strikes him as perfect. He says, "This is like gold, man." And I wonder if you could read for it a little bit. You know, you pop one in your mouth and say, you know, you'd be doggone if they weren't the best tomatoes you'd ever tasted.
At the time, I wrote in my notebook that they communicated cantaloupe and fresh pulpy mango with only a piquant tang at the back of the mouth to remind you that they were tomatoes. They crunched when you bit into them, releasing bursts of extravagant flavor, an encyclopedia of delight. If you closed your eyes, you might think you weren't tasting tomatoes at all, but some tropical fruit. And they were so sweet that Conti broke into a corny 1960s ditty. He started dancing around like a little child. "Sugar, sugar," he sang. "Honey, honey." We ate them continuously over the next 3 days, riding up and down the peninsula, checking out the farms, sitting around with Larry and his computer at the dinner table on the porch of their house in San Jose del Cabo. Like Jehovah's Witnesses of flavor, we brought bags of the tomatoes everywhere we went, proselytized for them, imposed them on friends. If we could have bottled that flavor, we'd have made a mint, but there was a hitch. These tomatoes were at the height of ripeness, but the people for whom they were grown lived at least 1,200 miles away. The buyers talking on their phones in warehouses in places like Nogales, Arizona, San Francisco, and Chicago, didn't know about them. Whole Foods and Trader Joe's didn't know about them, and neither did the Zuni Cafe or Alice Waters. As for the discerning shoppers, those willing to pay a premium for these exotic tomatoes, they were doing what upper-middle-class people do, typing on their Macs with family photographs, push-pinned to the cubicle walls in Manhattan and Minneapolis, listening to NPR in their bathrobes in Bethesda, Maryland, driving on the interstate through Golden, Colorado, or stopping for coffee at a Starbucks in Santa Monica. They were all far, far away. Would the flavor of these tomatoes survive the journey?
That always seems to be the question when it comes to tomatoes, unless they're right there in our backyards or in the farmer's market down the street. You've put yourself on the trail, as you put it in the title, of the perfect tomato. What put you on this trail, Arthur?
Well, you know, it started out as just a curiosity about the things that we eat. And I got the idea to focus on a particular crop. I actually initially thought about strawberries. But then tomatoes just seem to have so many different great stories behind them. And they mean so much to different people. They embody all of these feelings that we have about, our connection with nature and food and our families and so on, that it just seemed like a great way to encapsulate a search that would take me into sort of food history and the nature of our fetishes and obsessions and feelings about food.
Yeah, a fetish and obsession is about right when it comes to tomatoes. I mean, if you love them, and many people do, some don't, many do, people mm-hmm. really tend to love them. Take us back to the basics, Arthur. Excuse me. All my longing for tomatoes. Where did this strange kind of fruit come from?
Right. So originally tomatoes are native to Western South America, Peru, Ecuador, Chile, and many of them grow in very arid conditions where sometimes it doesn't even rain. They just get a little bit of dew off the ocean. And somehow they made their way up to Mexico because there's no actual sort of archaeological indication that the Peruvians or any of the people in these places cultivated them. They undoubtedly ate them. But there's no pottery that contains portraits of tomatoes.
No tomato temple remains.
There's no right. Whereas in Mexico, the tomato, by the time the conquest arrived, the tomato had just, was a crazy mad kind of attractive food there. And there were lots of different varieties. And there are these amazing descriptions of the markets at Tenochtitlan or close by, where there were, 20 different kinds of tomatoes. Some of them were probably varieties of what we in the U.S. call tomatillos. The Mexicans call them tomate. There were a variety of different things. But when the Spaniards came, these tomatoes were being served on everything. And the mole sauces and salsas and many of the things that we sort of take for granted as part of sort of, Mexican and Mexican-American culture were there in some form or another. Not probably that distinct from the way they are now with mixtures of tomatillo and tomato and chilies.
So here was sauces. A new continent where tomatoes were the tomatoes just roiling all over it. Here come the Spaniards, and what do we know, Arthur, about exactly how they jumped the ocean back to Spain and what Europe first made of this fruit?
Right. So it's kind of peculiar because the Spanish literature there. As far as anybody knows, there weren't any Spanish cookbooks during the 16th century or the 17th century. And so there's no written record really in Spain of what they made of these. However, all around the continent, you find them talk about them in botanical books, and they're described usually as loathsome.
Loathsome. Like as in just sort of disgusting.
As in gross, yeah, mm-hmm. as in something that only an Italian or a Spaniard would eat, one of these hot-blooded races maybe, but not something healthful for a northern European, certainly.
Is it true that they were thought of as aphrodisiacs and all that, or is that a wives' tale?
Well, I found no evidence other than the name Love Apple, which could have been confusion over the name. They may have actually been initially named Apple of the Moors, because there's some indication that Arabs or Arab traders brought them to Italy, possibly from Spain. And so there's a question of whether it was at Pomo del Moro, which would be, you know, tomato of the Moors, or Pomo del Oro, golden tomato, and or Pomo de Amor, right? De Amor, Pomodoro, Pomo de Amore. Anyway, there's a fair amount of confusion about the original meaning of this, but the first gut instinct of the Europeans was basically to say, well, this is suspicious, and it was backed up by the botanical closeness of the tomato to some poisonous plants.
But there it ended up right in the middle of the Italian cuisine, of the Spanish cuisine, just for starters.
Right. It did, and it took a while, though. I mean, even in we have less of a record in Spain, and it probably caught on sooner there. But in Italy, really, even in sort of the late 18th century, there are travelers' accounts of visiting Naples, which is, you know, where the pizza was invented,
yep.
and sort of the heartland of Italian tomato-based cooking. You know, that macaroni or the pasta there was served with cheese sauce and not with tomatoes. So, and however, there's probably also evidence that the Italian campesinos, you know, Italian sort of peasant farmers by then were growing tomatoes and eating them and had figured out ways to dry them, turn them into paste that you could keep for a longer period of time.
You say either and I say either. You say neither and I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. You like potato and I like patata. You like tomato and I like tomato. Potato, patata, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the hunt for the perfect tomato from ancient days to right now in your backyard. My guest is Arthur Allen. His new book is Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Arthur Allen joins us from Washington this hour. And speaking of what's good, we also have with us, with me here in the studio right now, J.J. Gonson. She's a local locavore chef with a background in short order and home cooking, founder of Cuisine and Locale, a personal chef service. Boston Magazine recently named her Best Personal Chef in Boston. J.J., thanks for being back with us.
Why, thank you, Tom. It's good to see you.
So, I mean, there's so many things that that we associate with summer, but what, maybe it's too obvious to even ask, but the tomatoes, smell
the tomato.
That fresh summer tomato smell, and you're right there.
Yeah. Well, the tomato needs just a huge amount of heat. It needs a lot of sun to do what it does, so it really only exists in that moment. When the sun is really intense, and in the Northeast, that means August.
Arthur Allen has gone on the search for the perfect tomato. We're going to hear how he did that. I mean, you put them into the dishes that you make. How do you decide? You just go and sort of feel whatever's in front of you there, sort of squeeze and smell, or are you looking
for
a particular
variety?
You can definitely
smell them. Well, oh, boy. I mean, there's so many varieties. Honestly, it's hard to even know. There's certain things, certainly, that I like better. There's some things that people think are fantastic that I find quirky and dry. It just depends on... usually, I like to taste a tomato before I commit to it. But also, I only use tomatoes for a very, very small amount of time because we only have them here for a small
because
amount of time.
Because you're a locavore kind of person.
That means
all in the rest of the year when everybody else is gobbling them
creative.
Up from Cabo,
right.
You're not?
No. No. And what I do, I know. It's hard. I think that when you choose a lifestyle that limits anything, it makes it more valuable when you get there. So, boy, when the tomatoes start to come in, I just live on them. It makes me so happy.
But, the waiting makes it so good when it finally comes.
It does.
We'll talk about how you work them in. Arthur, we've got a lot of response here from our listeners about where to find that perfect tomato. Here on the website, Elizabeth says, look no further than New Jersey. Okay. Vicky says on Facebook, my absolute must plant tomato are the Sun Gold cherry tomatoes. Dee writes, the best tomatoes are in my backyard. I only fertilize with coffee grounds and tea bags, never use chemicals. They taste so sweet. I make tomato sauce for all my friends with the extra all ingredients in that sauce except the wine, she says, from her garden. And finally, we've got Randy here, says, we grew 300 pounds of tomatoes in our backyard last year, and it wasn't nearly enough for our family of four. How did you set out to find the perfect one? What does that even mean, Arthur?
It's, you know, one of these searches that doesn't lead to a happy ending or to a neat ending.
Well, don't say that. We want a happy ending. We want
the
perfect tomato.
No, but it was just the pleasure of the trip. The pleasure of the journey was immense. I mean, I got to visit great heirloom farmers in California. I went to the heirloom festival there that's just out of this world, and went to Baja and tasted these fabulous tomatoes being grown there. I went to Italy, and I also went to Western China, which, believe it or not, is the world's second largest growing area for tomatoes after California. And it's one of these industries that grew up in China in the last like decade or two. And they make paste out of these tomatoes there. And they've got sort of the whole global tomato industry running scared. But, you know, I guess one point I try to make in the book is that nutritionally, it's the tomato doesn't have the same meaning as it does sort of in terms of our sense of flavor. I mean, when you eat tomatoes that are canned and they maybe even be sort of bland, you're probably getting just as good nutrition as you get when you're eating something, you know, really delicious and right out of your garden, as unpopular that's going to make me for saying that.
Hey, but we don't come here for a vitamin pill, for heaven's sakes. I mean, you know that you write very wonderfully. I thought you say, the taste of a fresh tomato like the juice of a perfect peach, or the smell of roasting peanuts in the bleachers, is one of the sweetest memories of summer. Mm-hmm. A tomato bursting with flavor is exquisitely unique. It contains sugars and salts and those ineffable oily flavors that we call umami, in a nod to the Japanese who lent us the word and the distinction. I mean, there's summer and there's that that bouquet of flavor that's kind of unmatched. I mean, does anything else come close to what is it about that juicy burst of that tomato, the depth of it?
That's right. It's just this combination of these different, you know, sensations that's so powerful and that are, and I found it interesting to talk to scientists who've tried to sort of parse what these flavors come from. And really, there's a kind of a large sort of cottage industry of scientists trying to figure out how you can grow tomatoes in the winter in one place that tastes like something that you'd want to eat, you know, a couple thousand miles away. And you know, there are those who say, well, what's the point? You know, why bother? Like your guests there, why even eat them if they're not growing around you? And okay, that's something I can't really argue with, but I think that a lot of people do want to eat them out of season, and I don't think it's a bad thing to want to eat them out of season.
If scientists are looking for the sort of magic of what makes a tomato so splendid, gives it that bottom and depth, what is that chemically? Have they figured out what's going on there?
Well, there's a guy who's from Australia, and he's about 85 years old, and he works in this laboratory in Albany, and he has bottled the flavor of cooked tomatoes, and he's also sort of isolated the chemicals that make the fresh tomato, you know, the most distinctive chemicals, although there's supposedly like 400 different volatiles that are important, and so you can get a sense of how difficult it would be to make. But then the complexity of actually breeding these into tomatoes, even just using traditional breeding, is immense. And I've met breeders. There's a wonderful man in Florida named Jay Scott, who, you know, the Florida tomato industry has basically over the last 50 years completely ignored flavor and just was all about producing big, firm tomatoes that you could cut very thinly at 4 millimeters per slice and put on a hamburger. Mm-hmm. And that's who they were growing for.
A la McDonald's, yeah.
McDonald's could care less what the tomato tastes like. And so this guy was like, well, you know, the Florida tomato industry is losing all of the high end of the tomato business to greenhouses and local farmers. And so what could we do to sort of back engineer some flavor into these tomatoes? And it's incredibly complicated, and it's almost impossible. I mean, it really, he gave me some seeds for something that he developed called the Tasty Lee, which I actually think is a really good tomato. But whether it'll sort of survive the Florida tomato business is another question. But it's very complicated because everyone actually does have a different sense of what the perfect tomato is. Well, you know, in sort of grosso modo, I mean, wasps tend to like, you know, firm tomatoes, you know. Latinos prefer acid tomatoes. You know, Asians prefer really sweet tomatoes. I mean, that's a gross, you know, but that's sort of the cultural traditions of sort of what you expect from a tomato. So there, right to begin with, you're dealing with sort of three extremely different ideas of what a good tomato should be like. And then there's so much that just has to do with, you know, the season they were grown in, and you know how much heat was there, and you know how much of the crop, you know, survived depending on where it's grown,
and the soil, the terroir, and all right. That is almost like wine. I'm not eager to sort of categorize people's tomato tastes. I find them so wide ranging across all mm-hmm. kinds of groups. I mean, you may be right. J.J. Arthur writes, I mean, it's interesting. I want to hear your thoughts. He says, everyone has his or her pet tomato. Mm-hmm. In New Orleans, they'll tell you you've never had one until you've tasted the Creole, which they use in gumbo. Up north in the Garden State, it's the big, juicy Rutgers, another joisy tomatoes. And there are people, he writes, who'll tell you that the best tomatoes they ever ate were in Greece or Italy or Thailand or Afghanistan. He says a lot of American cooks swear by Italy's San Marzano, elongated, angular, bright red Venus de Milo. But in southern Italy, some food snobs scorn this type. You're a locavore. You're in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. So what's your, you know, what do you go for?
When I'm drying them, I like a plum tomato that doesn't have too much juice inside it. If I'm cooking them into sauce, I want something that has a lot of moisture in it. If I'm slicing them on a salad, I want something that's going to have fun colors. It's almost specific to the application as a chef what I'm going to do with them, and I do play with them in different ways, and I think a lot about flavor and color. I have a lot of feelings about those Florida tomatoes, and I've experienced them far too many times, and I'm excited that...
You mean the sort of winter cardboard tomato?
The winter cardboard tomato,
but to be
yeah.
fair, that's not all they produce in Florida.
Oh, no, and you know, I think as somebody who tries to source food as close to possible, because I believe it is better tasting, better nutritionally, and also better for our economy, as somebody who does that, I actually feel very strongly about Florida and New Jersey as important parts of our food system on this coast. And there's many, many wonderful farms in Florida producing delicious field tomatoes as early as maybe even April. I have a friend in Florida who's picking tomatoes in her garden right now, and they're not cardboard tomatoes. Her tomatoes, they're wonderful. They have the sun and they've got that... that climate that the Italians found so fortuitous, that sandy,
yeah.
hot,
yeah.
slightly
it's there.
Damp.
But you don't have to be there. I grew up with them out of, you know, sort of prairie loam.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I mean, talk about the taste of summer and to be out in the mm-hmm. garden when they're finally, you know, coming into that deep red and that whole bubble of tomato aroma that hangs over the garden. I don't know, Arthur, maybe as much of the flavor is in the vine as in the mm-hmm. as in the tomato itself, but you're intoxicated before you even
right.
you know bite it. And when the dirt maybe is even still on it a little bit, just that dusting from the garden, let's hope there's no pesticides in there, it just adds to it. I remember when the women would gather and the men to pick and eat and can, mm-hmm. you know, Mennonite relatives, women with their sort of bonnets on, putting up just I don't know how many bushels of tomatoes late in the summer, Arthur. It didn't get better than that.
Yes. I mean, I think there's nothing like the experience of local tomatoes, either in your yard or at a farmer's market or at a local farm. And, you know, I mean, Florida has problems with tomatoes growing often because of the weather, which... and their soils that they grow commercially on, which isn't to say that there may not be, you know, farms there that do great stuff. I mean, California has the advantage of being able to control the water. And there's this kind of rule of thumb that I've heard.
You mean irrigation rather than rain?
Yeah, because what I've always heard is, you know, don't get their heads wet. Sort of when the tomatoes are you know, getting to be close to being picked, you don't want to get a lot of rain. It just makes it difficult. You start to get wilts and bacterial problems and so on. But, you know, it really is true that you just find everywhere around this country, you know, places and individuals who really know what they're doing and have the right, you know, gestalt for growing tomatoes. They know what varieties to grow where. But there is a lot of, I found one interesting thing when I was in California at this tomato festival. We were sitting around this table tasting about 300 varieties of tomatoes, and there was one that struck us all as just being really outstanding. It was called the speckled peach, sort of a little larger than a cherry, but smaller than your average, you know, smaller than a beefsteak.
Okay.
And it was just unbelievably delicious.
I've had that tomato.
Speckled peaches, is it yellow, orangish?
So it's orange-ish. Red with little specks, little petechia, you might say, and little sort of golden specks. So I bought the seeds, and I grew them in my garden, and it produced like crazy. I mean, it wasn't a problem of production. They were just really bland. They were nothing burger tomatoes.
Bland in your garden. So it all depends on how you do it. I remember my grandmother was yellow tomatoes. It had to be yellow tomatoes for her, and she would peel the fresh tomato, which always seemed like an awful lot of work, but she loved that peeled. Everybody's got their story. We've got a bazillion tomato-loving listeners here. Lisa in Milton, Massachusetts. How do you do it, Lisa?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I live in New England, where growing tomatoes can be challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But I stumbled across a secret 3 years ago, and that is planting tomatoes next to the dryer vent if your dryer vent faces south.
A south-facing dryer vent, and you've suddenly got a California kind of Baja breeze there.
Yes, my cherry tomato grew, if I had a trellis tall enough, it would have gone into the second story.
Of your house to the second floor? And was it bearing fruit all the way up there?
It was.
Wow.
It was a monster.
Wow, that's amazing. How about the flavor? Did it taste like your socks by the dryer vent?
I guess the question I had is, since it produced so many tomatoes and it was so big, they weren't the best tasting, and I wonder if I should have pruned it back.
You've got me there, Arthur. Yeah. What do you say to the dryer vent strategy?
Well, that's a fascinating story. I mean, in general, I think with tomatoes, sort of, when you have smaller fruit, you get better flavor in general, and it's also easier to grow the smaller tomatoes because they're similar to the wild types, which just have all this in this sort of, you know, history of that gives them this resistance to various organisms and so on. And I think, though, it's true that the more your plant produces, it tends to get watered down because the leaves only have so much energy that they can communicate to the, I mean, they can only produce so much sugar per whatever square inch of leaf. And all that stuff goes into the tomato. So when you have fewer tomatoes, you know, as a rule of thumb, you're going to have more flavor in the tomatoes. And that's why with heirlooms, you often get better flavor because those are not big yielding tomato bushes. You know, they compared to what commercial tomato growers get, I mean, it's a tenth or a fifth.
We'll talk about heirlooms. It's a subject in itself. J.J. Gunson, when you go out marketing for tomatoes to do your wonderful chef work, are you out there, I don't know, pushing and shoving with other in-the-know chefs who want just this one or that one? Are you battling for the best tomatoes? Is there kind of a tug of war?
Yes. Sorry, Tom, that's a short answer.
Yeah, that's a fine answer.
The battle... Well, last year, I think we'll all recognize, I'm sure we all remember, last year was a train wreck. We had this thing called late blight that just wiped out the tomatoes. And literally, I was calling farms and bidding. I was saying,
bidding.
I'll give you, if you'll hold a case for me, I'll be there by 6 o'clock this morning.
Wow.
Like, it was actually, I couldn't get the tomatoes I needed, which meant that I couldn't store the tomatoes I needed for the winter, and it was a tomato-free winter in my kitchen, which was hard.
Wow.
Well, you can go out to eat, and that's for sure, but it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew, you can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs, you can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side, put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour on the eve of Memorial Day weekend about the hunt for the perfect tomato from ancient days to right now. In your backyard, Arthur Allen is with us. He's gone on the great tomato safari, come out with a new book, Ripe, The Search for the Perfect tomato. J.J. Gonson is with us as well. She's a personal chef, and she knows her tomatoes. You can join us, New York, Watermill, New York. Billy, you're on the air.
Yes, hello there from Watermill. I have to tell you that your show is so informative. It's a thrill to hear this kind of enthusiasm for tomatoes. I've been a gardener for over 30 years.
Yeah.
And actually composting and using the green sand and the other ingredients, the bone meal and the espoma. And I was curious, first of all, what some of the ingredients are that the other listeners have or that your guests have that they suggest to put into the mix to make it a more fertile season.
Hey, Billy, what's green sand? I'm sorry, I don't even know.
Green sand is something that's, it's in the phosphate family, and you put it into the soil to enrich it and to break it up. Of course, where I live, we have a sandy soil, so it creates the right mix to hold on to water and of course, bone meal is I've always found that an ingredient that's very important.
And did you say you grow 30 kinds of tomatoes?
Yes.
Commercially or just for your own? You must have a very extended family in that case.
No, actually, I have two sons that love tomatoes, and I just like to give them away, too. And we make tomato everything. I mean, we start with breakfast with tomatoes. But there are certain tomatoes that I didn't hear mentioned, and one is the garden peach. It is actually like eating a peach. It has a peach fuzz on it.
That's good.
I do source some of my seeds from a place called Silver Heights Farms in upstate New York. They have turned me on to what's called a pineapple ground cherry. And I know that when I served it to some friends from Columbia, they said, oh, yeah, we eat this all the time. But they don't call it a pineapple ground cherry. I wonder if you're familiar with it. It's about the size of a large marble, and it grows encased in a... It almost comes gift wrap.
Mm-hmm. You're getting us all worked up here, Billy. Let us jump in on some of this. I'm thinking about tomatoes for breakfast. Absolutely. On a nice slice of German rye bread with a few onions on top. Garden peach, you know that one,
JJ? I know the garden peach and I know the ground cherry. Yeah, the garden peach is delicious. It really is. It's very firm, so you can slice it really nicely for salads. Mm.
And with that peach fuzz?
It is fuzzy on the outside, and wow. It's kind of peach-colored. Yep. You don't see them very often. I wish more people grew them. And the husk cherry or the ground cherry looks a lot like a tiny tomatillo, but when you put it in your mouth, it's got this kind of – it almost tastes like a strawberry mixed with a tomato.
That sounds pretty good. Arthur,
you buy them in pints, like raspberries.
Yeah?
Yeah, they're delicious.
Billy sounds like he knows what he's doing, Arthur. He's got 30 varieties going there, but he's still looking for advice. I mean, as you're out there looking for the perfect one,
I always say that, you know, I'm not a doctor and I don't even play one on TV, and I don't pretend to be a great gardener. I mean, I've been using fish oil, which works pretty well, and a lot of people like that. But he sounds like he's got a good system going there. I wouldn't want to rock the boat. plus, he's growing all these unusual things. I mean, bravo. Keep it up.
What did you see people doing, whether it was your geneticist down in the Baja or these pros who are trying to turn out the best?
I had a friend. He lives on a farm with my brother in Occidental, which is a very wet area that gets a lot of moisture, which is not always that good for tomatoes, although most of it comes in the fall.
Occidental is like where?
It's in Sonoma County, north of San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
But it's an area that gets fogs in the summer. That's generally not thought of as very good. He grows, 162 of his favorite varieties, and he uses, mixtures of bone meal. He uses earthworm castings because he says that, the earthworms basically go through the soil and digest it and make the nutrients in it more available to the plant than sort of other kinds of dirt. And he doesn't do a real complicated thing. But you will find, if you go on the web, lots of good advice. I mean, I'm not the best person to ask for advice about how to grow great tomatoes.
We've got a lot of advice coming in here. I think we're going to have plenty of sauce and more. Greg in West Newbury, Massachusetts. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I am enjoying this program so much.
Does it make you hungry? Does it make you salivate a little bit?
Yeah. Well, look, I've been growing my own tomatoes for about 20 years or so. I'm not quite as experienced as Billy, but, boy, I sure enjoyed hearing his stories. I have some recommendations. You know, with tomatoes, it's like wine. You know, there's different tomatoes for different purposes, and I everybody likes the big red tomatoes, and of course, there's that whole argument of hybrids versus heirlooms, but you know, there are some great hybrids out there. Big Boy, Fantastic, and Jet Sonic are three of our favorites.
Sure.
You know, and we've had tomato tastings with our friends, and they've all given them high marks.
A lot of those going in this weekend. You can be sure of that.
Yeah, you bet. In a cherry tomato, our absolute favorite cherry tomato is a tomato that grows wild in Mexico. You can get the seeds from Johnny's Selected Seeds in Maine. It's called Matt's Wild Cherry.
Matt, like the name, M-A-T-T?
Yeah, Matt's.
Okay.
Matt's Wild Cherry.
Yeah.
And you talk about tomatoes for breakfast. My favorite breakfast in the summertime is to go out first thing in the morning, pick a bunch of Matt's Wild Cherries, cut them in half, and put them in an omelet with a slice of Walla Walla tomato from the garden. I mean, Walla Walla onion from the garden. I'll tell you, it is heaven on earth.
That
sounds great.
You got us in tomato heaven. Thank you, Greg.
I would just like to point out that, you know, you've had three or four guests. They've all mentioned varieties I've never heard of. And I heard about a lot of varieties of tomatoes when I was doing this book, and it just points to this incredible sort of diversity and range in the tomato world, which I just think it's really fun and it's just wonderful.
Here's a little advice from Dee in Florida. She says, a great summer dish, pick a fresh tomato, cut in half, cover in garlic-infused olive oil, dash cayenne pepper, and bake for 10 to 15 minutes, 350, sheer heaven. She says, I can grow year-round as I live in Fort Myers, Florida. Another trick, plant peppers around or near your plants, and it keeps the critters away, as does garlic. There's something to try. And then I love this. Kathy on Facebook, she writes, I once had a cat who loved homegrown tomatoes and only homegrown tomatoes. He used to cry when I brought some in from the garden and would hop up on the counter unless I would hand him the trimmings. If I tried to give him the trimmings from store-bought tomato, he'd turn up his nose and walk away. That's a fancy cat. Hey, Arthur, what makes an heirloom tomato exactly?
Well, it's a tomato that's fairly old. I've heard there's different definitions, but I've heard 40 years, and it's something that's been handed down. But the main thing is that it's open pollinated, which means that you can plant the seeds year after year. A hybrid is something that's the seed comes from crossing two parents, which are usually owned by somebody, and it's a very secretive. I mean, Heinz. There's the tomatoes that the parents of the hybrid seed that they make and sell, you know, are locked in a vault somewhere that's right next to the Coca-Cola recipe or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's very, very deep, deep secret. So heirlooms are something you can pass along. You can grow them, and it's pretty easy to dry the seeds. You can keep producing them year after year. I mean, they're going to mutate sometimes, but sometimes that produces something interesting. But in general, they've been going for season after season after season and producing pretty much the same kind of fruit. And so people like that feeling of having something that has a tradition and heritage to it. And often they're also have really just good qualities and that's why they've been around for so long.
We've had a question from Eve in Tennessee, says asking why weren't tomatoes in traditional Chinese cuisine? I mean, how it made the jump from maybe South America and Mexico to Spain, but what about to China? And of course, today you'll find it in some dishes, but an awful lot traditionally, it's true, didn't have.
Right. Well, you have the tomato must have been brought, you know, from there was a Spanish connection between Acapulco and the Philippines, that's how they colonized the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And tomatoes went there, and people find wild tomatoes in the Philippines, you know, that are very well established, but they clearly are no more than, you know, a few hundred years old, those colonies or whatever. And they went around Asia. And you'll find places in southern China where people seem to have been eating them for a long time. But when I was in Beijing and talking to a lot of people about this, it seemed that it's pretty recent, and mostly very few specific usages, which was like to cook them with scrambled eggs or to put a lot of sugar on them and eat them as a dessert.
In China. Let's go to Aiken.
So why? I don't know.
Well, it takes a while when you've got a great cuisine. Aiken, South Carolina. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I guess my point is I'm of Italian extraction. My mother's from Naples. So, of course, the San Marzano tomato is very important to me. Tomatoes are communal. They bring people together as far as preparation of meals. For myself, I'd make tomato stregato, which means I squeeze them through a special pan by hand. My arms hurt for days after this. And, I'm not kidding you.
Tomato stregato, that sounds great.
Yes. So my wife's folks are from the Roanoke Valley, and they can. And both activities, I bring my kids' boyfriends over, and they help in the preparation. Canning is a big communal event. You know, that's what tomatoes for me are. I have a wonderful childhood memory. Growing up on Long Island, in Middle Long Island, actually, it was in Farmingdale. We were on the way to soccer game. There was a farmer, and this is in 1970.
Yeah.
There was a farmer who had picked his tomatoes behind a gas station, had a sign up, go ahead, you know, pick your own. And my parents, seeing that, we came back with 5-gallon pails, loaded up the 62 Galaxy, took them home. I was, as a kid, it was like slave labor squeezing tomatoes. It was forever, but
that's great.
It's a warm and rich thing, just like sitting in the basement of my Uncle Jasper's house.
Hey, absolutely warm and rich. I mean, what's warmer? When you can still feel the summer warmth in the tomatoes that you've just picked. What a great feeling in the hand. We've got more. I want to get these listener stories. Bowling Green, Kentucky. Thank you, Anthony. Bowling Green, Dudley. You're on the air, Dudley.
Yeah, I love your show. Listen to it all the time. Just a little observation about tomatoes and how things change a bit. In 1962, we had a family of 8, 6 kids, my mom and a dad, and my dad had a small garden out in the suburbs and fed the whole family all summer, and he would raise great big boy tomatoes, and I would take them down to a corner service station, the best tasting tomatoes you ever ate. And I couldn't sell them for 10 cents a pound.
Wow, bring them on over, Dudley. Yeah. We'll snack those up right now. J.J. Gonson, I mean, you hear the passion people have for these things. And at 10 cents a pound, we'd be all over what Dudley's dreaming of there now. But, of course, these days,
right,
I mean, sometimes you go to the market in the middle of summer when it's full tomato season, and the prices are just crazy through the roof. Sometimes I get so upset I can't bring myself to pay for what seems like it should be just nature's full summer abundance.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of labor cost involved in tomatoes.
Sure.
They're very maintenance heavy. Mm-hmm. They have to be harvested. They have to be brought into town. So you're paying for a lot of labor costs. And last year was a nightmare. But when you're talking about the prices at the farmers markets, what you're looking at something that I hear recently being called the real cost of food, as opposed to those hybrid tomatoes, which the difference to me between an heirloom and a hybrid is that a hybrid will produce a lot more that can be traveled further.
Right.
It's been bred.
It's bred to do that.
Right, and maybe you sacrifice flavor, as Arthur said earlier, because if you have a plant that's hyper-producing and being forced to hyper-produce, it's not going to have the same flavor in each tomato. So I think that you're paying a little bit more, but you're getting a lot more for what you pay for. You're getting something that hopefully hasn't been picked early.
Well, it's a big incentive to grow your own. Camille in Franklin, Massachusetts. Camille, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have one simple and two fancy recipes that I use every year because we grow 30 tomato plants a year. The first one is my husband and I eat a lightly toasted dark pumpernickel bread, lots of mayonnaise, tomato sandwich at least twice a day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lay out a couple more of those babies.
I love that.
And the two things that I make that are a little more fancy are tomato jam from my Kentucky roots.
Yep, yep.
And a tomato bread pudding. Which is to die for.
Lay it all out. We'll be right over, Camille. Thanks for your call. Let me get one more. Meg, thank you so much, Camille. Meg in Boston, you're on the air, Meg.
Hi. My best experience, I think, with tomatoes has been in Santorini in Greece, the island of Syra that erupted back in the Bronze Age. I'm an archaeologist and doing field work for a number of summers in the hot sun, sweating and being tired, leaning down and picking up one of the farmer's tomatoes and taking a big bite of that, and just fantastic in that special soil with the volcanic ash.
Mm. Which would you rather find, you know, a Bronze Age, I don't know, a sword or another one of those tomatoes there, Meg?
Well, you know, I'd probably go for the tomato myself.
Tough choice for an archaeologist. Our time is short, but that's so great. You write, Arthur, the flanks of Mount Vesuvius in a related zone as great tomato country.
Oh, absolutely. And they grow them dry there, which means they don't irrigate them. They get, if they're lucky, they get rain at the beginning of the season. And so at the end of the year, these are in this intense sun, and they get really intense flavors. I mean, very powerful flavors. I mean, I took my kids up there. We had these pianolo tomatoes, which they hang up to dry and eat in the winter. And my kids just couldn't stand them. I mean, they were way too strong, but I thought they were just amazing.
Speaking
just
of hanging up, JJ, upside down tomatoes.
Upside down tomatoes.
All over the place these
everywhere.
Days.
Everywhere. You walk into CVS.
What's up with that? Just to keep them, because the bugs can't get to
no,
them?
No, no, no. It's a great way to grow tomatoes. They like their roots to not be sitting in water. If you grow them upside down, their roots are up in the air. Gravity makes sure they're not. They get it's very easy to irrigate them without overwatering them. You can plant herbs in the top part of an upside down planter. I was going to say, if you have nothing but a tiny window, hang an upside down planter out your window and you can grow tomatoes.
And it will be there when you reach out your hand. You make us want to do that like crazy. I can't wait for this summer to get going, to get the tomatoes in, to be picking tomatoes. Wow. JJ Gonson with Cuisine and Locale. It is always great to have you with us.
Thanks so
much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom.
Cook up some great tomatoes
this
summer. And Arthur Allen, we're really glad you went out on the search for the perfect one. The book is Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Arthur, thank you for being with us today. It's just been great.
Well, thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Listeners, a happy growing season to you all. And when you eat those tomatoes, think of us. We'll be eating them too. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Memorial Day weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.